Motorola. This morning, Your Honors, I have the pleasure of introducing my co-counsel. First, furthest from the court, Mr. J. Timothy Eaton.
Morning.
To his left is Mr. Joel Blanchett.
Morning.
Both of the Ungaretti Harris firm in Chicago, Illinois. With the court's permission, Mr. Eaton will present an argument on behalf of Motorola.
Very well. Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The way this clock works, it's going to start with 20 minutes and count down.
Yes.
And so that will be your total time. The yellow light will come on that tells you you're into the time you've reserved. You can continue talking. You'll just be using up the time you reserved.
I understand. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Your Honor, may it please the court. Again, my name is Tim Eaton, and I represent Motorola, the appellant in this matter. Your Honors, as you know, the dispute that we're hearing today revolves around trying to determine the party's intent in the patent license agreement that was entered into between Motorola and Citizen Watch January 25, 1996. There's no dispute in this matter that it's a non-exclusive license. There's also no dispute that it is a royalty-free license that Motorola gave to Citizen Watch. In paragraph 4.1 of that agreement restricts the licensing to other parties, specific list, which is set forth as Exhibit A in the agreement. It restricts that sub-licensing to other licensees of Motorola. There's also no dispute below on the facts, which was presented before Judge Tolliver, that Amcor was one of the licensees that was on that list, and that Amcor had a license with Motorola that was entered into in 1993 and was paying royalties to Motorola for that license. Because this was a non-exclusive license, Section 5.5 permitted an assignment under certain conditions. One of those conditions was Motorola's consent, which is not present here. No consent was sought. The second was there could be an assignment to a successor in ownership, and that's the situation that's confronting us today. There was an assignment by Citizen Watch to Amcor, the PGA business unit.
As you've indicated, the record reflects there was an attachment and exceptions for the licensing. Does the record reflect that the parties ever discussed any exceptions for the assignments?
No, other than the argument below, Your Honor, was focused on what the agreement said and what the agreement provided. The only parole evidence, and we're not suggesting that parole evidence needs to be examined, but in the event that this court were to consider the two provisions ambiguous and would look to parole evidence, the only parole evidence we point to is the immunity agreement, which was part of Amcor's complaint. And we point to that for two reasons. Number one, to establish that it was a royalty agreement, and therefore the reason for 4.1 prohibiting this royalty-free agreement from being transferred or licensed to anyone else was to prevent current licensees from being able to deduct their obligations under those license agreements.
Was Amcor a current licensee at the time of the assignment?
Yes, it was. Yes,
there was still, in effect, a license arrangement.
Yes, Your Honor. That immunity agreement, which was signed in 1993, expired at the end of 2002. This assignment occurred in, I believe, March or April from Citizen to Amcor in the spring of 2002, and it was shortly thereafter that Amcor took the position, Motorola, we no longer owe you royalties under that other license agreement because we have now become the successor in ownership of Citizen Watch, who had a royalty-free license agreement.
Well, I know you're going to tell us how we should construe the agreement, but I had one more question.
Sure.
I think your reading of the agreement would basically say that you can have an assignment as provided for in the agreement, but then you read into it except to a current licensee.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're going to help us get to that.
I will.
Okay.
I will. The way we get to that is I believe what Judge Tolliver did below, and he set forth the analysis at the beginning that both parties had argued correctly. He set forth the statement of facts correctly. Where I do differ with his analysis is where he says because an assignment and a license are two different concepts, you can assign even though there's an anti-licensing provision in 4.1. That doesn't apply. And where I respectfully differ with him, Your Honor, is a license essentially is a right to use the patent that's involved here. So we gave a right to use our license to Amcor, and they paid us for that right. We gave a right to use our patent to Citizen Watch, and that was a royalty-free license. In the assignment provision, you are assigning all of the rights of that patent to the assignee. In this case, it would be Amcor, the successor in ownership. One of those rights includes the right to use. So essentially, you have a provision in 4.1 that says you cannot transfer the right to use this patent to someone who's on that list of current licensees. Amcor was actually the number one company list on that list. In 5.5, it says you can assign the right to use the patent to a successor in ownership. So if you examine those two and determine there's a conflict, then you have to look to rules of construction. And we would submit that the rule of construction, one of which you could look to, would be the specific governs the general. There is a specific prohibition in 4.1 against transferring the right to use to any current licensees. And under the assignment provision, that's exactly what they did here. They transferred a right to use. Now, I acknowledge that an assignment involves greater rights than the license. The case law is clear on that. But where the right to use is involved, and clearly in an assignment involves the right to use, the only way you can reconcile those two provisions is to determine by rules of construction which controls, because that presents a conflict. And we would submit that then you look to the more specific trumping the general.
Mr. Eaton,
yes.
Let's test that for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that one way to construe or to read together these two provisions in order to effectuate the result that your client is arguing for would be to interpret 5.5 to say you can assign but not to a current licensee.
Yeah.
But that interpretation would block an assignment of anything, that is, of any rights. The other way to do it would be to say that you can assign but one right that could, you can assign all rights to the business of which the license is pertinent except the right to use the patent royalty free, which means you're still transferring all but one of a bundle of rights. If one were to construe the two provisions that way, what would the transferee or the assignee end up with?
Not much. I mean, essentially, the assignment would provide, because they would have an assignment, probably the right to assign it to another party, but in essence, they couldn't assign the right to use. So the only way, Your Honor, we believe that you can reconcile that situation is that the right to use is conditioned upon 4.1, so that they would have the absolute right under 5.5 to assign it to a successor in ownership as long as that successor in ownership is not a current licensee of Motorola. And if you're looking to the plain meaning and the party's intent, because under Illinois law and likewise under Delaware law, you're trying to ascertain what did the parties intend. And I think it's clear here that where you have a royalty-free license, the purpose of 4.1 was to prevent exactly what occurred here, is that someone then would try to circumvent 4.1 by assigning to a current licensee into 5.5. And I think clearly 4.1 is the more specific provision. In analyzing the other terms of the agreement, 3.1, which has the transfer of the non-exclusive license and sets forth what the transfer is, 3.2, likewise from Citizen to Motorola, all the provisions are very specific. Except 5.5 is a general provision that doesn't even mention the parties. It's a boilerplate provision like other provisions in that contract. 4.1, though, specifically says Citizen shall not enter into a contract for the license of the two patents that are referenced in 4.1, which is the Lynn and Mullen patent, which were also transferred by half ownership under 4.2. It's a specific limitation on the use of those licenses. And that was the agreement that Citizen entered into. They received a royalty-free license on the condition that they would not transfer it for the use to any current licensee of Motorola. And that's precisely what they did in this case. So we believe that if you look at number one, the plain meaning of 4.1 and 5.5, we believe it supports our argument that 5.5 is conditioned on 4.1. We believe the other rule of construction, that if you look at the more specific term, that it conditions the more general term under 5.5. Another rule of construction, which is, wouldn't 5.5, if you read it the way Amcor is interpreting it, really make meaningless 4.1, because it would allow someone to circumvent, in our opinion, the intent of the parties by simply assigning to a party those rights to use. And, by the way, there would be no prohibition from them, Amcor, assigning back to what remains of Citizen that same license. And then Citizen could turn around and assign it to other people on the list, other current licensees, and not be barred, if that's the way you read it, the way Amcor interprets the agreement.
Mr. Eaton, two questions.
Yes, sir.
Does your, if this court were to accept your client's position, would it have to determine that assignment means something different or the same as a transfer of a license or the granting of a license? I mean, does it matter if those two terms are or are not the same to your position?
No, and let me explain why. I submit it is not; they are not the same concepts. I think the law is clear that a license is not the same as an assignment. But what I am submitting is that an assignment encompasses a bundle of rights which includes the right to use, which is what a license is. A license gives another party the right to use, and that is part of the rights that an assignment gives. So even though they're different terms, they're not the same. When you construe the contract as a whole, which we believe you must do, and which Judge Tolliver actually started the argument below, that if you construe it as a whole, Motorola wins, and we believe that is the case, because if you view that assignment clause with its definition, we believe it is conditioned upon the restriction to use the patent, which is in 4.1.
It's another way to state your position that even though that verbally the two terms are different, functionally they have the same meaning within the context of this agreement?
They do within the context of this agreement. Within the context of what the party's intent was, Your Honor, which was to prohibit the use of this patent by licensees who were paying for it.
All right, my second question is this. Your position is that the decision by Judge Tolliver effectively reads out of the contract, section 4.2, at least in part.
Yes.
Doesn't your contrary position read section 5.5 out of the contract, at least in part?
Your Honor, I agree in part, but I don't say it reads out of it. 5.5 allows an assignment to a successor in ownership as long as that successor in ownership is not a current licensee of Motorola. It also allows an assignment where there's consent. So 5.5 is a very viable position. It's just conditioned upon 4.1. And, Your Honor, when I talked earlier about parole evidence, I'm not talking about discovery. I'm not talking about depositions. All I was referring to in our brief and what we referred to below is the immunity agreement, which really became the very heart of this controversy between Amcor and Motorola. And if you look at that, you will see in Section 5.6 of the immunity agreement the same boilerplate assignment provision that is 5.5 in the agreement with Citizen. But what you will not see in that agreement is a 4.1. And why? Because that was a royalty agreement. It was not a royalty-free agreement, and that's a major distinction. The parties intended in the royalty-free agreement to prohibit the transfer of the use of that patent to another party who is paying royalties. So 4.1 obviously is not in the immunity agreement between Amcor and Motorola. So
your position is if we read the agreement as a whole, we have to conclude that construing it the way the Superior Court did makes no sense, because all of the reference to restricting existing licenses is totally meaningless if you can defeat it simply by executing an assignment moments after the contract is signed.
Yes, exactly. What I believe the trial court did was read out of the agreement the royalty-free aspects of it and the party's intent as to how they were going to protect Motorola from citizens being able to, as soon as the ink is dry, transfer it to one of the licensees.
Of course, you're putting the rabbit in the hat to an extent, aren't you, when you refer to the party's intent? I mean, that's the issue here.
Yes.
And to the extent that Section 5.5 confers a blanket right to assign without the permission of Motorola in the circumstances involved here, your interpretation would restrict that blanket right.
It would, Your Honor, and we believe that's supported by reading the contract as a whole in 4.1. And admittedly, as Judge Tolliver observed below, and I can't disagree with them, in hindsight, could we have drafted this more precisely? Yes. But I think if you are trying to ascertain what did the parties mean by the plain provisions here, I think it's clear that the intent here was to prevent someone else from using this patent world free.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You still have about 3.5 minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, John Reed for Amcor Technology. We believe that the dispute here begins with and ends with the plain meaning rule. Now, the plain meaning rule, this contract is governed by Illinois law. The plain meaning rule under Illinois law is no different than Delaware, but let me just for the record cite to an Illinois case, National Acceptance Corp. versus Exchange National Bank, where the Illinois Court of Appeals observed that the plain meaning rule provides that the parties to a contract are presumed to have intended what their language clearly imports. So why don't we turn to the plain terms of the patent license agreement. Section 4.1 deals with one thing and one thing only, license. If you read it, it says, citizen agrees not to offer to enter into or to enter into a contract with current BGA licensees of Motorola, including those listed in Appendix A, for a license. It deals only with a license. Then, if you look at Section 5.5, it says, you cannot assign without the consent of Motorola, except to a successor in ownership of all or substantially all of the assets of the assigning party related to the business unit employing the patents licensed hereunder, but such successor, before such assignment or transfer is effective, shall expressly assume in writing to the other party the performance of all of the terms and conditions of the agreement. It is undisputed that Amcor bought all of Citizens BGA business, and it's also undisputed that Amcor agreed to assume all of Citizens' obligations under the agreement. We don't think you need to go any further. There's nothing ambiguous about Section 5.5. Amcor complied with the unambiguous terms, and that should pretty much end the analysis. Now, Motorola says you have to construe the contract as a whole. We certainly agree. And they say, you look at 4.1, it creates an ambiguity. We believe, and I hope to demonstrate in a few moments, when you begin to go through the analysis and reconcile 4.1 with 5.5, what you see is it only confirms our conclusion, doesn't disrupt our position nor the position of the trial court below.
Mr. Reed, when you go through your analysis, will you help me understand what the business reasons would be for Motorola to make the argument they've made about construction and for the reasons that your client makes the argument that it makes about the construction? It's all very well to go through this legal contortion of plain meaning versus ambiguity and reading the contract as a whole and all of that, but give me a business understanding of why the parties would want it to be read one way as opposed to another, and in a way that makes sense.
Well, I think that the clear business reason is that the immunity agreement, the 1993 immunity agreement, which really should not be considered because you have to conclude first that the terms are ambiguous before you look at anything other than Section 5.5. The real reason is that agreement expired in 2002. Motorola would love to be in a position to get Amcor to have to renew that agreement and make significant payments, and they don't want Amcor to have gotten this patent the way that it did under this assignment clause. Pure and simple financial reasons. Interesting, when you start to do the analysis.
But basically, from a business point of view, your clients could have been saying something like this. You know, a good way to get around paying Motorola is simply to buy Citizens. Let's buy Citizens and save ourselves all that money, because the way we read Citizens Agreement, it's got this exception, and we won't have to pay anymore. So wouldn't that be your client's business reason?
That would be an additional reason as well. Absolutely. It's exactly what they did.
But from Motorola's point of view, they would probably be saying, we're getting this money from Amcor. The last thing we want to do is enter into an agreement where Amcor can get out of paying simply by buying Citizens.
Well, that begs the question as to whether or not that's what they did.
No, I understand. I'm just trying to help you help me understand what would be a response to Justice Steele's question. But those seem to be the business considerations. One, does Motorola really want to forgive getting money by simply allowing Amcor to buy Citizens? And on the other hand, is there a real possibility that Amcor can stop paying the money by buying Citizens? Isn't that the business debate?
Absolutely. And our position is that they can't stop, because now they're in the position of Citizens and they own the use of the patent, which we believe is permissible under the agreement. And when you begin to go through the analysis, I don't think you can reach any other conclusion.
Well, I apologize for interrupting your strong desire to get right to your analysis, but I understand what the business argument is now. What I'd like to understand is, explain to me why this agreement would have been drafted in the way it was drafted and signed at the time it was signed. What then would have been the understanding of the parties about how it would work in the business world? What argument makes the most sense? Not what somebody can make of it later as the facts have changed by raising issues about ambiguities and plain meaning and construction as a whole and all the rest of that lego, my short for mumbo jumbo.
Well, Justice Steele, your question is, in all likelihood, direct hit the wrong party, because we were not parties to this agreement.
Well, I've never had
the time
a chance to ask a question of the other party, so I'm asking you.
I don't know. They were involved in the drafting. We were not. It was between Motorola and Citizens. For whatever reason, they chose the language that they chose. All we're arguing is that under that language, we ought to be allowed to do exactly
what
we
did. Well, let's accept for a moment, for the sake of argument, what Motorola said. Why would your client, when they bought Citizen, look at this agreement, understand this agreement to mean something different than what Motorola has argued? Why would, for example, Motorola ever expect this to be interpreted in a way that would allow a license to be passed royalty-free to someone who's already paying royalties?
Well, there's this. Keep in mind, what 4.1 prohibits is Citizen keeping the license and using it, and also giving a sublicense to Motorola. They wanted certainly to avoid that. Here, all Motorola does is step into the shoes of Citizen.
I'm basically asking the same question Justice Steele did, but in a slightly different way. In order for your side to prevail, don't you have to persuade this court that Motorola, when it entered into this agreement as a business matter, would have consented to a contract which, on the one hand, prohibited your client, prohibited Citizen from assigning or sub-licensing under the patent to Anchor, yet would allow precisely that if that if the transaction took the form of an assignment of the entire business.
Well, sure, because it gets into it actually gets into the analysis because
okay,
they
but
are.
Why would don't you have to be able to articulate a reason why Motorola would consent to that arrangement?
Sure.
Why would they do that?
They would
as a business
because
matter?
Because you're talking about two different things. I don't know what their business reasons may or may not have been, but the fact of the matter is a license, the consequences of a license and a consequence of an assignment are in fact two different things.
But we're trying to explore the intent of the parties, so I think it would be helpful if you could tell us why Motorola's intent was different than was just suggested by Justice Jacobs' question.
Can't answer that question. All I can say to this court is that you derive the intent from the plain language of the agreement.
But that's another way of saying they were simply out-lawyered. If that wasn't what they contemplated, the fact of the matter is everybody had lawyers, and they were out-lawyered.
Well, but we don't know. We would have to go through discover. We'd have to first conclude that the terms are ambiguous, and then we'd have to get into discovery to find out. We don't know, for example, let me just give an example. This thing's all about a license. It's called a patent license agreement. It's all about the license. The law is clear that if they had stopped at Section 4.1, that agreement would not have been assignable. I mean, let me skip a little forward in the analysis here and read from an often cited case from the Ninth Circuit, CFLC Inc. versus CADRAC. It says, it is well settled that a non-exclusive license of a patent has only a personal and not a property interest in the patent, and that this personal right cannot be assigned unless the patent owner authorizes the assignment or the licensee itself permits the assignment. That's the law. There isn't any other law out there to the contrary. In the context of a non-exclusive license, which this is, that contract was not assignable. For all we know, Citizen said to Motorola, fine, we'll accept these terms, but we want to be able to assign this contract in the event we decide to sell our business. And Motorola says, sure. As long as whoever buys your business agrees to be bound by all the terms you were bound. And lo and behold, that's exactly what they did. And what's interesting about this, that contract was not assignable. Motorola had to make a conscious decision to decide to make this contract assignable. And they did it. And not only did they just put a blanket assignment clause in there, they put specific conditions on it.
So your position is, by doing that, Motorola assumed the risk that one of the purchasers would be a current licensee.
Absolutely. See, what I don't understand is that if it's their understanding that when you get the assignment, you get all the rights that go with the license, and they know that, and that's the contract language they negotiated, and they certainly put, we point out in our appendix, we attach copies of the charts we use below for the trial court, the difference, what they could have done, it's at the record, I think, B17 and B18. They could have taken the exact same language that they used in 4.1 and said you can assign this contract except to then existing licensees of Motorola.
Mr. Reed, our problem here is that we don't have any record. And by granting summary judgment, the court below, in effect, was holding that Motorola's position, Motorola did not have a reasonable legal position, and that the only tenable legal interpretation of this contract was your side's interpretation. That's as a matter of law. But how does that hold up when you take into account the common sense business considerations that have been argued for here by the other side?
Well, I think it does hold up under the law, because the law has recognized for quite some time that there is a difference between an assignment and a license. And that's all the trial court said.
The argument is that there may be a verbal difference in the abstract, but there's no functional difference in this particular case. What is your response to that argument?
Oh, but there is a functional difference. I mean, the only way there's no functional difference when you're talking about licenses and assignments is if the license is an exclusive license. The U.S. Supreme Court, in I think the McKenzie case, recognized that, and they needed to do that so that a licensee, because the owner of the license has given up basically all the interest in it when they give an exclusive license, so that that licensee would have a right to sue for patent infringement. That is the only area of the law in which an assignment and a license merge. Otherwise, there's a great divide as to how they're treated under the law. And that's what the trial court said. You're talking about a license on one hand and an assignment on the other. You had specific language and conditions with regard to what you could do with a license. You had specific conditions with regard to what you could do with an assignment. And we know that you had to have made a conscious decision to make this agreement assignable, because it was not. Under patent law, it was clear this agreement was not assignable but for your agreement to do it. And you put language, you know, you had the opportunity to put language in there that would have prohibited this exact result, and for whatever reason, you didn't do it. So I don't think there's any problem with the record in the case. Both sides agree that the clauses are clear. They just say there's an ambiguity created by the fact that you get a license when you get an assignment. There's nothing novel about that.
Didn't Judge Tolliver say on a couple of occasions, I think his word was seriatim, he said, if I read the agreement as a whole, it appears that Motorola should prevail. But if I read it seriatim, it looks like Amcor should prevail. Isn't that what he concluded?
He certainly concluded that. He made those statements before he had really been presented with any argument at all. He made those statements at the beginning of the argument. I'd like to think that I convinced them otherwise by the end of the argument. You know, whether you say you read them in seriatim or you're construing them together, the fact of the matter is, I think the reason he said that you read one after the other is because this whole thing's about the license agreement. And so you start with that proposition. You have a license. It's non-exclusive. By federal patent law, it's not assignable. Then somebody goes ahead and makes the conscious decision to make it assignable. So it's not a situation where, you're talking about the same subject. What happens here is 5.5 is actually the more specific provision. 5.5 modifies 4.1. 5.5 takes what it was an otherwise unassignable patent license agreement and makes it assignable. And in addition to doing that, it puts specific conditions on it, all of which we've met.
If we disagree with that characterization, that is, if we were to conclude that the more specific provision was 4.2, does that matter to your argument?
I would say no. And the reason I say no is you're talking about two different things. I would respectfully disagree with that conclusion if the court were to reach it, because I think there are two different things. But if you're going to talk about one provision overriding the other, it's clear 5.5. The federal case law is clear that 5.5 is the provision that overrides what you can do with that agreement.
If we disagree with your characterization, what I understand you to be saying is that your argument fails.
I would still say no. And
right.
And I would say the following. Their basic argument is this: when you get the assignment, you get the license, and therefore, by getting the assignment, you're violating the licensing provision. I think that's what it is. But I guess my response to that is, of course you get the license when you get the assignment. That's what happens. You get the license and plus more. And when somebody enters into an agreement that allows somebody to get an assignment of a patent, they know that they're getting not just the right to use the patent, which is the license, they're getting use and ownership. And you can't complain later when somebody goes ahead and gets exactly what you agreed to give, which is exactly what happened here. They don't like the conclusion here. But that is not a basis to rewrite the contract.
So I guess that's where you differ. They're arguing that if we read the contract as a whole, there was an exception implicit in the assignment paragraph, and you're saying we shouldn't be reading implicit exceptions. If they wanted an exception, they should have put it in there explicitly.
Right. There are two exceptions in the assignment contract. You have to acquire all or substantially all the business, and you have to agree to be bound by citizens' obligations. We did that. There are no more exceptions. What they want you to read into this is that there's an additional exception that you can assign if it happens to be to a then-existing licensee of Motorola. But that language is simply not in the contract. You know, they make what I think is an astounding statement in their page 16 of their reply brief, and that is they actually say that 5.5 needs to be modified. They've never alleged any basis below that, you know, there was mutual mistake or that somehow the final language that wound up in 5.5 was not the language agreed to. They've never asserted a basis for rewriting the contract. And if you look simply at the plain terms of 5.5, you really can't reach any other conclusion than what Amcor did was perfectly proper.
Are you saying that they have to establish a mutual mistake in order to claim that there's an ambiguity in the contract?
Absolutely not. What they said is the contract needs to be rewritten. I don't know what their basis for that statement is as to why the contract. I mean, that suggests that somehow that provision doesn't effectuate their intent. Well, I can't imagine, you know, there are lots of things they could have done if their intent was something different. But all we can really deal with is the language in the contract itself. They could have done, like I said, they could have omitted 5.5 and not allowed the contract to be assignable at all because it wouldn't have been under federal patent law. Or they could have put that additional language in there, very similar to 4.1, that would have prevented exactly what happened here. Let me sort of sum up with a basic principle. Under Delaware law and Illinois law, to quote Newcastle Properties versus Shalwitz, the Illinois Court of Appeals, a court cannot remake a contract and give a litigant a better bargain than he himself was satisfied to make. This principle is recognized in Delaware in the In Re Explorer Pipeline case, where the court said it is not the proper role of a court to rewrite or supply omitted provisions to a written contract. The court must accept the words chosen by the drafters. If you look at the words with the understanding that a license and an assignment are two entirely different things under the law, the words allow us to do exactly what we did, and the trial court appropriately entered summary judgment in our favor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Mr. Reed.
Your Honors, I have just a few points I wanted to address, and I'll go right to the business reasons. We know two things. In 1996, when that agreement was entered into with Citizens Watch and Motorola, one, there was an existing agreement with Amcor that was paying Motorola royalties, and two, the agreement with Citizen was royalty-free. Those are facts. They're not in dispute. And in fact, within the four corners of the agreement that we're interpreting today, it lists Amcor as one of the licensees, and it lists a number of other licensees. So we know at that point that there are these license agreements out there, and 4.1 restricts Citizen Watch. That was part of the bargain, from being able to give the right to use those patents, which they're getting free to other people. That we know. That is in the record. It's not in dispute. And that was the underlying business reason for that patent license agreement and the provision in 4.1 and 5.5. That was the party's intent, and I think it's clear. Later, when there is this assignment from Citizen to Amcor after there had been this master purchase between the two entities, attached again to the record is the intellectual property assignment agreement. And in that provision, it has a deferred payment with respect to the rights that were going to be transferred from Citizen to Amcor because there's a doubt whether that would be valid. And it says, in fact, until that is determined, this payment by Amcor will not be made to Citizen Watch until a year or so later. So the parties recognized that that was going to be an issue, and they actually deferred the payment that Amcor would have to pay Citizen because they didn't know whether they were going to get the Motorola patents or not.
You're talking about a holdback?
Yes. It's in Section 5 of the Intellectual Property Assignment Agreement, which is in the appendix and part of the record. So when you look at the business transaction here, it doesn't make any sense for either side to take a position that would interpret the contract to allow exactly what the parties intended it not to do, which was to transfer that right to use. And I acknowledge that an assignment and a license are different, but they both involve the right to use, and that's what's at the heart of that patent license agreement in 1996. And just one other quick point. Counsel referred to Motorola's reply brief, and if you read the paragraph where that statement is made, we are saying Section 5.5 must be modified to effectuate the party's intent, which is expressed in Section 4.1. That's all we were saying, is that 5.5 has to be read in the context of 4.1. We were not seeking to redo the agreement. So we respectfully urge Your Honors to reverse the judgment of the trial court. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Reed. Mr. Reedman, the court appreciates your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and take a brief recess.
Please rise.